Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. In Terrence Hawkins' most recent novel, American Neolithic, the U.S. has become a, quote, police state light, unquote. The Patriot Amendments have fundamentally transformed the Bill of Rights, and creationism trumps science. The Supreme Court now has a watchdog called the Patriot Tribunal, which can overturn its decisions. Surveillance and the drones of the Homeland Police are ubiquitous. In this world, attorney Raleigh finds himself defending a suspect in a hip-hop murder unlike any he's ever seen. His client, Bling Bling, is very different. In fact, so is his DNA. And in this dystopian world where evolution has been jettisoned, what happens in this police state when it's confronted with a living missing link? That's the predicament at the heart of Hawkins' 2014 novel, which was named as one of the best books of that year. It ran into some publishing difficulties with the publisher, and now it's been revised and is out in a new edition from Tulsa's Calliope Group, a new book publisher here. Terry Hawkins is the author of two novels and many short stories and essays. He founded the Yale Writers Conference and now runs the Company of Writers, offering workshops and manuscript services to writers. He'll be talking about American Neolithic in two events in Tulsa, Thursday from 6 to 8 at Nothing's Left Brewing at 1502 East 6th, and they'll do a craft talk Friday evening at 6:30 at Magic City Books. He joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Terrence Hawkins, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, this book, American Neolithic, I was surprised to learn as I was reading through it, I saw that there was original copyright date of 2014. It was originally released 5 years ago. It received great reviews, was named Book of the Year by Kirkus Reviews, and now here you've rewritten it and re-released it again this year. There must be a story here. What happened?
Well, there is, but some of it is covered by a settlement agreement. So I have to be fairly circumspect in discussing that. But suffice it to say that the original publisher and I had a falling away. And I was trying to figure out what to do with the book because I didn't want to see it go out of print. And it so happened that my friend Sean Crawford of Tulsa, Oklahoma, was starting a press. And so American Neolithic found a new home. It was also an opportunity for me to incorporate some new science into the book and also to not directly incorporate changes in the political climate, but at least to redirect some of the book's flow in that respect. When I refer to the new science, when I started writing this book, believe it or not, there was absolutely no hard evidence for human-Neanderthal interaction. And now, of course, yes. You know, you can pay $20 or whatever it is, $200, and get 23andMe to tell you how much Neanderthal DNA you have. And we've discovered new archaic human species that we didn't know about 10 years ago, or 5 years ago even. So This was an opportunity to update the book.
Now, there seems to be somewhat of a W. Bush sort of mentality to some of the dystopian elements. Did you rewrite any of that? It was published in 2014. You must have been in the Obama era when you were writing this, when everything was kumbaya.
Well, I actually made a point of making a reference to some of the less progressive aspects of the Obama administration.
Right, sure.
Because now, of course, I mean, I hesitate to say this, but the James Buchanan administration seems like the good old days. But it's true, there was a George W. Bush aspect to the origin of the book. And it was also very, very much affected by our political response to 9/11. That is, the passage of the Patriot Act and the curtailment of civil liberties that we continue to deal with today. For example, the controversies, real or imagined, about the FISA court and the FISA warrants. Those are relics of the post 9/11 era. But to be clear, at the time, a lot of civil libertarians were outraged at the Obama administration's crackdown on leakers and also the use of drones to kill American citizens overseas.
Yeah. Now, This book is a piece of speculative fiction, dystopian fiction, if you will, and it's always been around, but it seems like it's more and more prevalent today, certainly in our television and video watching. It's everywhere now. Would you agree? And what would you attribute that to? Is this sort of a new age of anxiety that encourages sort of thinking about things in speculative and dystopian ways?
Well, I think it's a direct response to the world in which we find ourselves. I mean, leaving aside the political aspect completely, California is burning.
Right.
Miami is disappearing under the sea.
Right.
The world my nieces and nephews inherit is going to look a lot different than the one we were able to enjoy. You know, we lived in a world, we grew up in a world, I assume we're of the same vintage, early 20s. but we grew up in a world in which there were four distinct seasons, for example, which has changed in the past 10 years. So as we were talking a little bit earlier, I was thinking about the other ages of dystopian fiction, and it occurred to me that Brave New World was a response to the 1930s, and of course, 1984 was written in 1948, when Stalinism, the true extent of the horrors of Stalinism, were making it into the Western press. So I think the rise or the increased popularity of dystopian fiction is in part a response to the daily news. But to be clear, dystopian fiction has always been with us, but it's usually been over there on the science fiction shelves, and it's kind of made its way out now.
And it's mainstream now.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, American Neolithic is this thought-provoking book. It's very funny at a lot of times, chilling at others, and it offers a very different view on our culture, on immigration, and what it means to be human, which I have this sort of connection with. We seem to be fascinated by zombies now, and this takes a very another different view of what does it mean to be human?
Well, it's interesting you should mention zombies, because I just listened to a podcast from NPR on Throughline about the origin of the whole zombie story. And just as a footnote, I remember being at a writer's conference somewhere talking to somebody who had written a zombie book. And I said, you know, that stuff is over. Of course, I was completely wrong, as I am about so many things. But to return to the point about the prevalence of these images, I guess I have to loop back to the point that it all springs from our present experience. And also, I think that in an age in which we are surrounded by technology that apes, so to speak, humanity, we're curious and actually driven to know who we really are, what separates us from the things that seem to be mimicking us. And, you know, there's anxiety, a lot of anxiety about artificial intelligence, and that, I think, drives a fundamental need to know who we are and why we're different from everything else.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the book. In the America of American Neolithic, the Patriot Amendments have curtailed civil liberties. These are amendments to the Constitution. The Fair to Faith Clause in those amendments means science is now secondary to religion.
Yes.
The Homeland Police are hyper-vigilant everywhere towards any crime that could be linked or may be linked, or even they don't like the look of it as far as how it relates to terrorism. Tell us a little bit how you constructed this world.
Well, I suppose to really address that, I have to go into how I write, and I think every writer has a slightly different approach. But I started by playing around with the idea as I was writing it. And as certain ideas moved forward in the prose, I then went back into what I had done previously to reintroduce them. So it occurred to me that in an age in which religion trumps science, and I chose that word inadvertently, but it seems to work, a lot of things that we currently take for granted would be curtailed. For example, I mentioned at one point that the red states are entitled to install what are called decency filters on everybody's home computers or portable computers so that pornography can't be accessed, which is why a lot of red staters go to New York where they can buy it. another idea was the certification of any statement of scientific fact being fair to faith. That is, presenting a religious alternative explanation to science.
And also, I believe in news reporting, there's an accuracy in media bureau that will challenge every report.
Yes, and that actually came up in the revision.
Of course, fake news, right.
Yeah, exactly. So to tell you the truth, I mean, as events move in the real world as opposed to the one I live in, the proliferation of the whole notion of the unreliability of the news is something I never anticipated.
Right.
I don't think anybody could have anticipated. But it's just so easy to persuade people that the evidence of their own senses is unreliable.
You start the book, though, with a lawyer named Raleigh.
Yes.
Raleigh seems to be, he's a throwback in many ways. He still loves paper.
Yes,
he loves
does.
Books.
He does.
With paper, not e-editions. He reads a newspaper that is not an e-edition. He fills out the crossword. And he notes, ironically, that with that decency laws, that all the red staters come to buy their pornography on paper.
Yes.
Tell us a little about this character. He's very engaging and just seems flummoxed by where he finds himself in life as an attorney in this day and age.
I think being flummoxed at where you are is a condition of middle age, where I was. I think I was just about in the middle of middle age when I started writing this, though I thought of it as the latest possible youth. As a character, I think he is modeled on some of the protagonists from Raymond Chandler or Robert Parker, because he's got that way of talking. I always characterize him. There are two narrators in the book, as you
yes.
know. One is a Neanderthal named Bling Bling, and the other is his attorney, Raleigh. And they have very different voices, and I always characterized Raleigh's as being the voice that comes out of my mouth, and Bling Bling's as being the voice in my head. So,
no.
Yeah, he, and I hate to say this, but a lot of women don't like Raleigh. A lot of my women readers don't like Raleigh at all.
Hmm. That makes sense.
Yeah, it does. It does. He, in that respect, he's kind of a throwback as well, because he says things that would no longer be considered politically correct. And one of the interesting things, actually, about writing in his voice and then revising his voice is that some things he said would have been perfectly acceptable in 2014, but not in 2019.
Right.
For example, what is now called the R word is thrown around, and I had to get that out, at least out of his direct speech, because it would have been found too offensive, and justifiably so. I mean, our sensibilities move along.
Right. And you mentioned the other narrator, which is this Neanderthal, which Raleigh has brought into the case. There's been a shooting in a hip-hop feud between two clans, and Bling Bling is, I don't want to say a mascot, but he's a dancer, that he's a part of the entourage, if
yes.
you will. And he's been discovered by the person that's thought to be the shooter in this particular crime. But Bling Bling is picked up because he's holding the gun at the end of the day.
Yes, yes, he's holding it by the barrel, but still he's picked up.
And we meet Bling Bling through his, it's almost perhaps monologues or writings. Is it writings or is it, because it's a combination, I think.
Yeah, well, you pose an interesting question, because in the first draft, in the first version, I never solved the problem of, and it's not giving anything away to say that Bling Bling is imprisoned in an undisclosed location 2 years after the events Raleigh describes. And the problem I had is, well, if he's imprisoned in an undisclosed location, how is it that he's writing? So I decided that he was pretending to write. And that's how we're able to hear his voice. Bling Bling's backstory is that he is the last literate Neanderthal. He taught himself to read.
And he's very literate.
He is very literate. because he's literate and because he kind of understands our world, the rest of the members of his band or tribe are living in an abandoned Chinese restaurant supply warehouse on the Lower East Side. And they don't need much money. They survive on dumpster diving, by and large. But he is sent out into the world to earn what little money they need to buy Starbucks for their religious ceremonies.
Well, and what's interesting is in the course of the book, we learn Bling Bling's backstory of how their tribe operates. They are meat eaters almost exclusively. They dumpster dive to find that. And they're trying to negotiate this world in which they have always been the hunted.
Yes, that is exactly right. And they've always had to live on the periphery of our world.
Sounds very much like immigration today.
Exactly. Exactly. Though I have to be candid. I did not see that. It was not my intent at the time I wrote it, but it's absolutely there.
Right.
I don't see some of the things that are influencing me as I write, and I think of them as purely coincidental or just sort of targets of opportunity. But there are a lot of references to my hometown in the book that I... But there are so many that I had to have been doing it for a reason, I guess. And the other is... The other point of similarity there is I have the Neanderthals working in the coal mines of Fayette County, Pennsylvania, in the 1930s, where my grandfather would have been working at the same time. Mm. So, it very much is a story of outsiders.
My guest today is Terrence Hawkins. He's a writer, director of the Company of Writers, and prose editor for Blue Mountain Review. His book is titled American Neolithic. It originally came out in 2014. He's done a revision, and it's now being re-released by the Tulsa Calliope Group. He's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. It's a great read, dystopian read, of this attorney who's representing this Neanderthal who's found in the course of a shooting. And, of course, the big question is, what does law enforcement, what does everyone do with this knowledge, in a time when knowledge for knowledge's sake is being discounted?
Well, it's not only knowledge for knowledge's sake, but given the fact that scientific creationism is essentially the state religion, proof of the existence of a Neanderthal is going to be a big problem that has to be solved some way. Bling Bling is initially thought of as being somehow deformed.
Right.
And it's only after a mandatory DNA sample that we find the truth.
Right. And there's a really touching scene when Bling Bling describes his attempts to become educated, to read and to learn. And he decides at some point to go to the New York Public Library.
Yeah.
And when he goes to the library, he meets the human members of the underclass, in which he all of a sudden finds this kindred spirit. And when he's walking up the steps, he encounters this person, and all of a sudden he says, oh, the guy confronts him, and then he goes, oh, sorry, man. And he goes, I can pass. That was a really wonderful scene
that you
wrote.
Thank you. In some ways, I think his quest to become educated and his love of learning for its own sake, knowledge for its own sake, as you were saying earlier, is one of the things that makes us human.
Yeah. Would you like to read for us?
Yes. Well, speaking of learning to read, here's how he learned to read. But as I say, I soon exhausted the mother's ability to teach. The mothers are the matriarchs.
The maternal group that runs the hive, you will.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Which is the group of Neanderthals. They live in groups.
Yes. And they can sort of read to the extent that they can tell us that octagonal red thing is a stop sign. But that's about the limit of it. I tried to learn more on my own, mumbling over traffic signs, comic strips, magazine covers, all of which stubbornly kept their secrets. True, I could tease out a sound or two, but Dilbert might as well have been written in hieroglyphics. But then I found the Rosetta Stone. One November midnight 30 years ago, I was given dumpster duty on East 4th Street, usually slim pickings at best. The neighborhood in those days consisted of actors struggling against the bus ticket home to Minnesota, upscale heroin addicts, and cheap ethnic restaurants that catered to both. So I was disappointed, but not embarrassed, by the lightness of my backpack as I ducked down an alley between Cucina de Pesque and Ali's Albanian. I tripped over it, literally. It was a Seagram's box, the kind people beg from liquor stores when they move. I picked myself up off the slimy pavement and dragged the box. it was surprisingly heavy, to a fire exit with an overhead light. It was full of books, not just any books, books for the youngest readers, Brown Bear, Pat the Bunny. As I pawed frantically through them, I almost wept. If only I had someone to read to me, how much I could have learned. But there was more than just books. There was an object a little bigger than a computer keyboard, cheerful red plastic with rows of big square toddler and Neanderthal friendly buttons, each bearing a letter of the alphabet. I pressed A. I nearly soiled myself when the toy spoke. A, it said. The letter glowed. I pressed again. Ah. A third time. A. Fourth. Ah. I tried the next letter. B, said the same sunny voice. I pressed again. Buh. My hands shook. Inspired, I pressed A, and keeping it depressed, B. Ab, it said. B first, then A. Bah. Sobbing and laughing, I stuffed my precious into my backpack. Should I press my luck no further, or should I take more? Suddenly struck with fear, what if I should make myself too conspicuous with an overstuffed bindle and lose it all to a couple of addicts? I decided to limit myself to half a dozen books. Desperate to get out of the alleyway and back to the nest, I picked my Alexandrine library almost at random. Seconds later, I was back on Fourth, as inconspicuous as a caveman in the East Village could be, which, at 4 a.m, was very. I moved as fast as I could without running, and as alertly as I could without seeming furtive. Though the police were not yet formally invested with arbitrary lethality, all the street people, even Neanderthals, knew that one wrong move could end in a punitive rape or a shallow grave in the meadowlands. However fast I traveled, my emotions ran faster. First, I was exultant, Prometheus bringing fire to his benighted people. Rapidly, though, my joy deteriorated into anxiety. What if I stepped in front of a cab? What if those staggering Jersey boys in their fog of beer and Dakar Noir decided to round off their New York night by stealing my pack? What if I had left the power switch on and the Rosetta Stone was draining its life away? What if I had left it behind in my haste? Twice I ducked into deep doorways to assure myself that the keyboard was both present and active. On the second occasion, I was so relieved that I burst into hysterical tears and clutched it to my chest, settling to the stoop and rocking it back and forth as though it were an infant snatched from a burning building. Finally, crooning terms of endearment, I secured it again in my pack and crossed the last few blocks to the nest. Despite the noise two padlocks and their chains must have made when I violated the bankruptcy trustee's seal, no one except the oldest mother was awake when I made it to the fourth floor. We sleep long and deeply, another reason we will die with me. After a long study, she said, "Forgive me, but I don't think we can eat any of this." But because she was not only the oldest mother, but the oldest mother of my descent, she knew me for who I was. Thus, a smile played around the edges of her eyes, if not her lips. "No, great-grandmother, we can't." "Then, great-grandson, of what use is it?" "Great-grandmother, I cannot tell you yet." "And why is that?" I leaned forward confidentially. The smile had migrated just barely to the corners of her mouth. She gave me her ear. "Because, great-grandmother," I said, "I don't think we have enough batteries."
I love that line. And really, that must have been a fun scene to construct, because really you're telling an elemental story, you know, in all of human development and all in Neanderthal.
Yeah.
I mean, it's Prometheus the fire in a
That's,
way.
As I was reading that, I saw that for the first time, to tell you the truth. I hadn't realized completely that had things turned out differently, that Bling Bling might have been a much different figure for his people.
Right. Well, as you mentioned at the very early part of our conversation, we know that things don't end up well for Bling Bling. He is in an undisclosed location, captured, imprisoned, and he's relating the story to us that way. But I think the central question will be Raleigh's role in that, and you don't have to tell us what happens, but Raleigh has an essential dilemma, because the laws of the land now require an attorney to completely work with the government when the government says you have to work with us, or you are likely to see the same fate as your client.
Yes.
So he has this existential decision to make at some point in the book. Does he stay true to his client, or does he stay true to what is now the law? not the law he knew either.
Correct. That is the fundamental question of the book. And we were off air when we were talking about Tom Perata.
Yeah.
When this book got started, it was written exclusively in Bling Bling's voice. And I talked to Tom. Tom was one of my earliest teachers.
He wrote Mrs. Fletcher, which is now an HBO series.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. He told me two things that really shaped my approach to the book. One is that a little bit of Bling Bling goes a long way. and he was completely right, because I didn't think I'd be able to write a whole book in that voice, because it's dense.
Right, it is. I mean, he is an intellectual Neanderthal.
Exactly. He's a powerhouse. And the other is, remember, this is Raleigh's story. And those two bits of advice completely shaped the book, because I realized that however sympathetic a character Bling Bling is, and he is a sympathetic character, he doesn't really change. He's acted on rather than acting. And as you point out, Raleigh has a fundamental decision to make. Whose side is he on? And the resolution of that question is something that I actually didn't know until I wrote it, pretty much. So it kept me on tenterhooks.
Well, we look forward to this new book, American Neolithic, which is actually a book from 5 years ago. You must be happy to see it back out.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I have a great deal of... I think the word would be fidelity to what I write. I can't stand the idea of something, you know, finally disappearing. I had previously hoped that the stuff I published online would remain there forever in some form, but no, when people get tired of paying that $16 a month to Squarespace or whatever it is, it's gone. Yes.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I am very, very happy, and I'm very grateful to Sean for taking this on. These characters continue to stay in my head, and I'm glad to see that they're out in the world again.
Yeah. Do you think you'll write about them again at some point?
You know, I actually made a stab at a sequel. I'm not completely comfortable with it yet, because the present political landscape is changing so rapidly and so dramatically that I know that something I finish a year and a half from now is going to look hopelessly dated. And the other thing is, the book kind of ends where it ends, and sometimes you just have to let things go.
Now, you do have a collection of stories coming out.
That is
soon.
Correct.
When is that happening?
It will officially release May 1st. It's called Turing's Graveyard, and it is similar to this, to the extent that some of the, about half the stories are pretty much driven by idea as much as character. You know, can the internet be haunted, for example? I'll leave it at that.
Okay. Terry, thanks very much for joining us.
It was really my pleasure. Had a great time.
Writer Terrence Hawkins speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His 2014 book, American Neolithic, is now out in a new revised edition from Tulsa's The Calliope Group. He'll be talking about the book in two events, Thursday evening from 6 to 8 at Nothing's Left Brewery at 1502 East 6th, and doing a craft talk on writing Friday evening at 6:30 at Magic City Books. That's co-sponsored by the OSU Center for Poets and Writers. That's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.